The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
Welcome, everyone, to the EMS Educast. On behalf of Bill Toon and Rob Terrio, this is Greg Fries, broadcasting live from central Wisconsin. As always, it's a wonderful place to be. Rob is traveling, as you've maybe heard him say on recent episodes. He's at the Health One EMS Educators Conference in Colorado, presenting a whole slew of presentations, and he also had a chance to go on a ride-along today. So he is doing that instead of joining us, and we wish him the best. And but we do have our good friend Bill Toon. Bill, you're also on the road right now. Can you divulge your location?
Okay. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. Enjoying, and I'm attending the Society of Academic Emergency Medicine's annual meeting.
Okay.
And it's day one is done and under the belt, and we go through till Saturday noon. So several days of fun and enjoyment and lots of research, lots of presentations.
Has there been anything so far that's really made you go, wow?
Oh, they're not wow, but there's certainly some really interesting and good research going on. I heard some stuff today dealing with utilization of end-tidal CO2 in shock states.
Okay.
Also using lactate as well as base excess for point-of-care testing. So some interesting stuff. I'd have to go through my notes for some of the other things that I've heard, but just in general, it's been a good experience.
And are there many other paramedics or EMS leaders there, or are you sort of a party of one?
Well, there's certainly physician EMS leaders that are here. And typically, if you know, many of those physician EMS leaders are also involved in the training of emergency medicine residents. And that's really what this program's for. So, but there certainly is a strong group of people that are on the physician end, because many of these young residents are former paramedics that have gone on to become a physician, so they cherish their roots. There might be, but probably if there is, there's a handful, and I haven't met them yet.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're there and hope you can find some good things to share with us. I always appreciate it when you send me links to journal articles with one-word subject line like interesting or read. So keep them coming.
Will do.
All right. David, welcome back. David Blevins.
How is everybody today?
Real good.
That is excellent to hear.
You're real welcoming. I find, you know, that when the sun comes up early here in the summertime, I wake up with the sun. So maybe it's some sort of like farming heritage or something. But now as the sun is still above the horizon, I'm totally exhausted. But we'll get this done.
I understand that. I've been on the road the last couple of days and at home. I did a presentation earlier today and with my wife for an education technology conference. And now just settling in for the evening.
And what was the topic that you presented?
Chuck E. Cheese.
Chuck E. Cheese, I don't get it.
I did the topic, the title, it was off the wall. I did college where a kid can be a kid, talking about, you know, utilizing some of the same kind of techniques in a more grown-up manner, but using some of the same techniques they use in elementary, middle, and high school in our colleges. You know, why are we just lecturing all the time? Why not, you know, we were talking about technology, using iPads and tablet devices and using apps. And so I've got a lot of apps that we use to actually bring out the body during our paramedic program. So they had me using iPads and technology in the classroom. So I thought it was kind of interesting. I did a play off the Chuck E. Cheese advertisements from many years ago.
Well, I hope that went well. And we do have a guest tonight, and we're so glad to welcome back to the show Laura Cathcart. Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
So I say welcome back to the show, and that when we broadcast live from New Orleans at EMS World Expo, with our friends from the Medicast and the EMS Garage, that you were on the show. Probably just a little bit to talk about, you know, your background in EMS and your research in your PhD research. And so at that time, I thought, well, we got to have Laura back for a longer appearance, a full episode. So it's been, gosh, you know, 7 months, but for listeners that maybe have missed that episode or not heard you speak before, maybe just start out by giving us a nice long introduction of who you are and what it is that you do, but education background, how you got involved in EMS, sort of lay it all out for us.
All right. Well, thank you very much for inviting me back. I'm working on my PhD. I'm in the final stages. I'm at the point where I'm just writing, and I'm a doctoral student at the University of Maryland, College Park, and I am studying curriculum and instruction with a specialization in science education. And the population I'm studying is paramedic students. And so I am an EMT, and I've been an EMT for 12 years, almost 13 years now, and I got started doing that basically because I was bored when I started college, and I wanted to do something to help others that was fun and exciting. And so I started out doing wilderness search and rescue, and that just wasn't enough. So I literally started volunteering at my local fire department, and the bug bit me. And so I became a firefighter, I became an EMT, and I love it. And so I volunteered since. I volunteer in Prince George's County, Maryland, and I'm currently volunteering with the Laurel Volunteer Fire Department. And my bachelor's was in, the title is insane. It's Cell and Molecular Biology and Genetics.
Okay.
Which, if you really want to know what that is, I essentially studied microbiology.
All right.
I could have called it microbiology, but I thought the fancier title was neat. So, and then I went on, I taught high school for a little bit. I said, you know, I really need to get back in grad school. I really like the harder sciences. I like studying stuff more. And so I got recruited to run the undergraduate microbiology labs at the University of Maryland while I was working on my master's in science education. So I did that for 6 years. And my master's, I did a thesis master's, and it was in infectious disease education and how novices and experts approach problem solving and how they think about the problems. And I got to a point when I finally decided to start my PhD, I realized, what are you doing? You know, you really love EMS. You love being an EMT. Why are you splitting yourself in so many different directions? Why not become an EMS educator? And I've been toying with the idea of becoming an EMT instructor for years. So I said, you know what, let's just go do this. So I went through the process in Maryland, and I'd already taken all the classes. I just hadn't actually become certified. So I went, I became certified, and I started teaching EMT classes, and I fell in love with it. And I decided, okay, you know, this is what you're going to study. You're going to find something to do. And you're going to make your PhD your way of combining your two passions, your passion of teaching and researching science, and your love for being an EMT, and you're going to combine it all together. And that's kind of how I got to where I am right now.
You have an MA in curriculum and instruction and an MS? Am I right on that?
Well, so I just have an MA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but you were studying towards a... I got confused there when you talked about graduate school, the first go-round.
Yeah. So there was some discussion, believe it or not, one of my advisors, I've had many advisors along the way, there was some discussion about whether or not I should go and get an MS also.
Okay.
And I took a lot of classes towards that, and it was eventually decided that it's not necessary. I have enough classes, and it wasn't necessary for what my eventual career goals are.
Okay. Bill, it sounds like Laura in about a third of the time has earned just as many degrees as you have, if not more.
She's a much smarter person than I am.
I don't know if we'll have a test of wits later on, but... Laura, you've been busy. I was going to say this cell and molecular biology and genetics degree, you said shorthand for that is microbiology. And I was thinking shorthand for that is usually pre-med. I mean, that really struck me as like maybe at some point were you on a pre-med path?
The thought never actually crossed my mind until I graduated with my bachelor's, and it crossed my mind many times throughout graduate school. There were many, many hard days where I said to myself, Laura, what are you doing? You're teaching students that are going to medical school, and you would love to be there. You would love all that knowledge. What are you doing? You're taking the harder path, and you might just end up there yourself one day. And I've never gone there. I think it's almost a frustration I have with our healthcare system in this country and the route you take to get there and the educational system you take to get there. And I would like to step back and change it almost. And I realize that I can not take the hard path of medical school and still have a great impact on patients' lives and their health care and changing the system from a different path.
Well, I would greatly disagree with you.
You think I should just go?
Well, it's not a question of that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the efforts that you're doing and you know, having a PhD and then going on to medical school, particularly with your strong science background, certainly would be of benefit. But the thing that you could do with your understanding and appreciation is that you could influence possibly in a more substantial and powerful way with the kind of credentials that you could get under your belt there. And you would like the event I'm at, you would love everything I'm hearing and listening at this. And this is one of those opportunities that would be afforded you, particularly if you decided to explore emergency medicine as your background. But every discipline has its academic component. And, you know, there are plenty of physicians that are true academics that their primary role is to develop future physicians. And think of all of the patients you could have in contact by extension, by all the people that you educate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trust me, the thought does cross my mind frequently.
I would guess there's very few paramedics that haven't toyed with the idea of like, oh, maybe I shoulda, coulda, woulda. Ever crossed your mind, David?
Probably earlier in life now with the fam and
yeah.
God, I'm good with where I am.
Right. So, Bill, do you have more questions about Laura's background and how she got to this PhD program?
No, I'm really interested to hear the work that she's doing now and particularly how she sees her applicability to EMS education and the development of future practitioners.
Yeah, so we'll get right into that in just a moment. First, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsor.
This episode of the EMS EduCast is sponsored by EMS Manager. You have to try this software for yourself. It takes the chore of employee scheduling and management of EMS providers and makes it easy to set up, easy to maintain, and easy to manage. And with a mobile web app accessible from smartphones and other mobile devices, an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web, managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make requests or changes to employee scheduling from anywhere. Pricing is based on the size of your organization, so it's always affordable, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud. This means there are no additional local IT costs to worry about, and there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. I want to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast, as well as many of your favorite EMS programs from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and to support what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes to check out the free trial at emsmanager.net. That's AlladTech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workforce management. Visit emsmanager.net for your free customized trial of this amazing employee scheduling and management tool. emsmanager.net.
So, Laura, before we took that pause there, Bill asked you to just dive right in. Tell us more about this PhD program that you've been involved in, and then specifically the research that you did that you're starting to write up.
Sure. So all of this got started as an independent study my first year in graduate school. I was working with an immunology professor, and he had implemented concept mapping in his immunology class. And so for anybody who's not familiar with concept maps, hopefully most people in our audience are fairly familiar with an incident command chart, or maybe let's say a triage flow chart. And so if you want to think about a concept map, instead of following the incident command chart to try to understand who's in charge of what on that command chart, or following the triage flow chart to let's say you're trying to rapidly or systemically categorize mass casualty patients, think about a concept map. So it's a way to link ideas that could be fairly distinct and to kind of graphically portray the complexity of the bigger picture. And so he had briefly instructed his students on how to draw concept maps, and he'd given them a list of anywhere from 10 to 20 different concepts, we'll call them. These were ideas or concepts for each lecture he gave the students, and said, go ahead and draw me a concept map for each of these lectures. This was a voluntary extra credit assignment, and at the end of the semester, he had all of these concept maps. Now, he had done this to kind of help his students in hopes of helping them kind of adding to this traditional lecture course. And he wanted to see, okay, you know, is this helping their learning? Is this benefiting the students? You know, what are they getting out of this? Only he didn't know how to analyze any of these concept maps. So he turned to me as this new science education graduate student and said, hey, Laura, can you help me out with this? So I said, sure, I'll work with my advisor. I'll tear through the literature. I like concept mapping. I think it's pretty beneficial. Let me see what I can help you with. I dove into the literature, tried every which way I could to analyze these concept maps. And these concept maps were pretty unique in that they didn't follow the traditional concept map framework that was defined traditionally by Joseph Novak, who kind of founded or invented concept maps in his 1984 book, Learning How to Learn. And the reason why they didn't follow that traditional framework is because they weren't hierarchical in nature. And so it wasn't that one big idea was at the top and then lots of little ideas branched off from that. These maps, they were kind of more freeform. And so I did find a way to define them in the literature. They were more network maps. And I was able to find some analysis techniques in the literature that people had designed for these. And even after applying all these, tweaking their analysis techniques, working pretty hard with these, I really couldn't find anything helpful for the instructor to kind of make sense out of this 200 plus maps that he had collected throughout the semester to help him gain any useful insight into what his students knew about the immunology material. And at the time I was working with an organic chemistry educator, and he suggested that I read a paper called, it was working with something called knowledge-based theory, which is actually a mathematical theory. And what it does is it looks basically at the presence or absence of an idea. And so I looked at this and I kind of went back and met with my advisor, and I looked at him and I said, Mike, you know, I don't see how this is really going to help me. These people are looking at multiple choice tests and they design these specific questions, and the question is either right or wrong. How is this going to help me? I'm looking at concept maps. And he said, Laura, don't you get it? You know, they design these specific questions about one concept and it's either present or absent. Just look at your maps. The concept is either there or it's not. And the light bulb kind of went off and I went, oh, now I see this way to analyze these. So I kind of ran with that idea, and I designed a whole new way to analyze concept maps. And I guess you could call it knowledge-based theory, but that's a lot of mouthful of jargon. So I call it KST. And all it's doing is it's comparing either the students' maps to each other, a group of student maps, or if the instructor has some sort of prediction of how they think the students will perform based on how they taught the students that lesson, comparing what the instructor thinks the students will know to what the students do know. And you look for the presence or absence of ideas. And what you end up with is a product that can basically give you percentages of students' ideas that are present compared to absent. And you can actually color code this. So you end up with a really beautiful concept map that's color coded. It has numbers, and you can pick up misconceptions. You can pick up alternative conceptions. And the process of actually doing this analysis, it turns out, is the most valuable part for the instructor, is what I'm finding doing all of the dissertation work.
Maybe I interrupt here.
I'm going to take a big, deep breath because it's a lot to think about.
And I just want to sort of visualize. So say if, like, the starting point is, say, heart failure. Like, you start in the middle with heart failure, and you might have a branch off of that that's signs and symptoms. And, mm-hmm. like, if I wrote down jaw pain, which is...
Yes.
It's an idea, but it's not a correct idea, right? So,
okay.
Like, is that, so you could score that of like, well, Greg, you offered up jaw pain, you know, pain that radiates to a jaw, but that's not actually a symptom of heart failure. That's a symptom of an acute coronary syndrome. So that's how you could score that as like something that went wrong.
And so in this method, it's not really the way this would get tallied in this per se is the instructor would predict per se that would fall under, if they taught that and they wanted the students to understand that the jaw pain might fall under, like a symptom of an acute MI or something.
Right.
And if that appeared under like, under another type of heart problem, like you were just saying, then that would show up as a misconception in this type of analysis. And so you could actually see in percentages how many of the students have that misconception, and raw numbers, how many of students don't have those ideas, like aren't even thinking to put this on their map. Like this isn't even a connection that the students are making at that moment in that context.
So the absence of something could also be important. And like, not only did you list the right things related to the concept, but you didn't add stuff that's unrelated?
So, or that is related. So it's a matter of how detailed. So the instructor controls what the instructor thinks, how detailed the instructor thinks they taught it to, what level of detail they think they taught it to, and the level that they predict the students. The instructor controls the level of detail they predict the students will give. And you can also compare it to the level of detail that other students give. Okay. So there's two different ways you can look at it. How much detail does the instructor think the students will have versus how much detail does the average student have by comparing all students?
Are these being, like, when somebody says drawing a concept map, are, like, people literally drawing this on a big flip chart? Or is this, like, 8.5 by 11, or is this a computer program?
So there's many ways that you can do this. There are computer programs out there. So initially, the maps that I were given initially, they were literally just drawn on 8.5 by 11 paper when I did the immunology work. And then when I went about doing this with the paramedic students, I used a program, a concept mapping program that the pioneer Joseph Novak designed. It's called CMAP Tools. And every now and then a student just wouldn't use the program and they draw them by hand, and that's fine. And sometimes to demonstrate to the students what was going on, the instructor would just put them up on the chalkboard, sometimes on flip charts. Concept maps can be drawn any which way. One of the reasons why I chose this instructor for my study is that the instructor has been using concept maps for a very long time and literally has just long sheets of paper that are rolled up just in the classroom that from students that have been drawn year after year after year of concept maps that they can pull out for the next class to look at year after year. So I'm very flexible with how concept maps can be drawn and looked at.
I'm going to jump in here. So let's say you are doing it in an instructor development, an EMS instructor development program, with relatively novice instructors, people that are maybe just beginning to teach in their program. How would you present what you're doing now to them, and how could you convince them the benefits of this that they could have in their classroom?
So first of all, they need to be introduced to concept mapping. And the first thing is that I would have them participate in a concept mapping activity. So I would want to ask them, you know, have you ever participated in concept mapping activities? One of the great things about concept maps is that there's lots of data, research, educational research that shows that concept maps are pedagogically useful for students. The actual process of drawing them helps the students link ideas in their head, take them out of their head and link them. Drawing them on the paper helps them link them and understand them a little bit better. It's just like a student can be helped by taking something that they think they understand and then teaching it to another person. It's just like the process of they think they understand something, but they're going to take notes about it. It's just like they think they understand something, but then they're going to outline it. It's that same idea, but this is another way to do it. It's taking something and putting it into a complex graphical organizer. Only in this way, it's actually taking distinctly unique ideas and organizing them in a way that looks at the big picture.
Okay. So again, I'm just pushing you here a little bit because our listeners don't have the benefit of seeing the visual that could be created here. So let's now go back even a step further. If you'd want them to prepare for your class, what direction would you send them to for resources to prep for the class so they could come in ready to do a concept map in the classroom, then so you can go through and explain it and then relate it to how they can utilize it?
So the two best resources that I have found that I rely on concept mapping, and they're surprisingly old, is the original book.
Excuse me, be careful.
I'm sorry?
Bill's really old. He's
yeah, you said old.
He's sensitive about his age.
No. I mean in terms of literature. So the original book by Joseph Novak is called Learning How to Learn, and it was published in 1984, and it was co-authored by a gentleman named Gowin, G-O-W-I-N, and Joseph Novak is N-O-V-A-K, and I'm sure we can get that in the show notes. And one of the best review papers that I have ever seen written about concept maps was written by Ruiz Primo and Shavelson, and it was published in 1996, and it's called Problems and Issues in the Use of Concept Maps in Science Assessment, and it was published in Journal of Research and Science Teaching. And between those two resources, they're going to give you the best overview of really what concept mapping is and how to utilize it. And then I'm sorry?
Well, I was just going to say, I've got the book in the show notes, and I think I just found the paper that is Stanford's got it online. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
That would be awesome.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
And then in terms of being able to use the analysis technique that I'm talking about, I'm developing worksheets. I have worksheets. It's one of these things that you have to be comfortable with concept maps. You have to be comfortable with using them. And I have developed a handout to teach people how to use it. And I really think it needs to be something, though, that needs to be turned into software or added on to software so that to minimize the analysis time. So that it can be used a little bit more readily for the practitioner. Because at this point, it's still in a research format, and that's great, because once you become as proficient at doing the research, like myself, the grad student, that, you know, this is all I do, you get fast at it. But in terms of a practitioner, they would like to have their students go in, draw the concept maps, and then they grade, right? Or it would be an equivalent of grading. They would like to analyze and then have some sort of, oh, that's pretty neat. You know, look, I've got a student over here that says this and a student over here that says this, and I think that's pretty similar. And, wow, I've got three students that say this idea, and I can't believe they're thinking this because I didn't teach anything near like that. And, wow, I need to go back in and address this. And the idea of software that just highlights that for instructors is fairly powerful. And that's what's fairly neat about this. And that's actually one of the most interesting things that I found about doing all of this research. I actually have a quote from the instructor that I've been working with, if you don't mind me. She says, it definitely helps. I don't know if it would ever be appropriate to share this with the students, because my fear is it lacks context and it would just become another study tool that gets passed from class to class to class, and it won't have as much meaning if they actually do it themselves. Just like for me, sitting here and doing it with you has a lot more meaning than you doing this yourself and handing me a report. It just speaks towards the effort. And so this instructor has worked, you know, done the actual analysis with me, the old-fashioned way, by hand. But I wonder if I were to sit there and hand her, you know, a ready-made list where we didn't have to write down each sentence by hand, if she would still be able to get the same benefit of the analysis out of this concept mapping analysis technique. And that remains to be, I mean, that's a different research study right there.
Well, that's often the case, isn't it, that one research study uncovers the next 10 possibilities. So a software that would really sort of be a machine grading process that it would be just looking for patterns and what people missed or what they included and highlighting that to the...
Well, all it would really be able to do is pull out words, the same words, and line them up in a list. And then truly where the instructor would come in is to say, all right, all of the phrases that had these same words in them, okay, are they similar or not? Mm-hmm. Like, are the students saying the same idea or do we have different ideas here? And that's really what this technique is getting at. It's getting at this qualitatively similar idea. And that's kind of what's key here is it helps the instructor tweeze out between maps. Are these students saying qualitatively similar ideas or not? Even though they may be using different words.
David, you're in the...
So would you...
Well, I was just going to...
I'm sorry.
Invite David.
Go on to David.
The primary paramedic education business. David, how does this resonate with you? Are you doing concept mapping? Do you have questions about what Laura's discussing?
Well, I've actually spent the last few minutes while I'm listing, kind of reviewing the topic in more depth than what I must say that coming into this, I'm kind of sitting back as a listener and trying to develop what questions. And so my answer to your first question is no, I am not currently using this. And sounds like, you know, from what I'm reading and what I'm hearing Laura say is, you know, there's a great use for this. My question is to you, Laura, I want to get started with this. Where do I start? And so, how easy a question could that actually be?
My first, I'm going to turn it back into a question to you is, you want to know how you want the concept maps to fit in, where you want them to fit in. So for instance, when I was working with the instructor that I've been studying, you know, she kind of looked to me and was like, okay, so what concept maps do you want to add into your to this program? How do you want to study the students? And it was, no. This is your class. You already do concept maps. I'm here to study what you do. We're just going to analyze them in a slightly different way. And all I'm asking is that we do them in a slightly different format. And so come to find out when I talked a little bit more, she had a huge laundry list of topics that she already knew were fuzzy with her students from years past and that seemed to fit this notion of students drawing a concept map. For instance, particularly complex ideas or particularly complex broader topics that she would love to have students connect together in a network-like fashion and draw together. And one of the first ones that we did was the autonomic nervous system. And her students learn about this the first week of class. And so literally at the end of the first week of class, they've already been taught what a concept map is, how to draw it, how to use the software, and then bam, they're given a list of these concepts that have to do with the autonomic nervous system. And they're told, all right, next week, beginning of class, bring in this concept map and turn it in. And it's the analysis, working through the instructor, the analysis of this, and this map has actually been done twice. It was done the first time kind of piloting this, and the second time around collecting more data. It was fascinating working with the instructor to see her learning of where she thought the students' gaps were and then where the actual gaps were, and to see how she wanted to adjust her teaching. And it was a very, very powerful tool. And it's an additional tool. It's an additional, assessment. It could be used formatively. It could be used summatively. And some of the other topics that she chose and that we worked on, she designed one around respiratory medicines. When we chose to do that, she chose to leave off every single medicine. And she just gave the students a blank instruction that said, here are all the terms you have, but you are also to add in every single respiratory medicine. And they were adding in things that aren't even typical respiratory medicines. They were adding in all kinds of things that do affect the respiratory system that aren't typical pharmaceuticals that you would think about. And she thought that was phenomenal. There was a shock one. Shock is huge. Shock relates to so many other things. You could expand a shock concept map to be as big as you wanted, or you could shrink it down. That one, it was a matter of how big do you want to make this or how small do you want to make this that was confining it. That was the trick. And then the one that was truly the most fun for me, and we're still in the process of analyzing this, was the students all had a common experience. They did an activity. It was called the Airway Rodeo. It was a simulated small-scale mass casualty drill in which it was called the Airway Rodeo. And all they had to do was manage patients' airways. And they had very limited airway equipment. And all of their patients had serious airway problems. And after that experience, they were all told, draw a concept map about your experience. And from that common experience, we were actually able to pull back and analyze and pull together and analyze and actually construct a common composite map from that to see what the students had in common and what they didn't have in common from that experience to help kind of as an assessment of that experience, a very unique assessment of that experience.
Is there a gallery somewhere where we could see some of these maps or
see some of the composites? Yeah. So if you look at the show notes from last time, the last time I was on the show, in the Prezi's I have, there are some of the slides and some of the Prezi's, there are, two of the composite maps.
So that was episode 150, listeners, and we'll put that into the show notes, the link for that episode.
One of the things that when you spend the amount of time that you've had in a topic area, and it's very clear that you've gained the mastery of this, the challenge I think that you have and is how do you make this very tangible. Now, and again, I've worked with concept maps many years ago, and I can't tell you that I work with them routinely now. But for example, David brought up a good point. Here's a guy that's an instructor, smart guy. He's trying to see, okay, how can I apply this? What's my return on investment? How do I know that my students are learning more, gaining more, retaining more of what's going on? And as I said, you see it because you're so immersed in it. I think the challenge is trying to get other EMS educators and also is equally as excited about it. And the other thing is remember, not all EMS educators really run the gamut. Some of the EMS educators are people that have been EMTs for a long period of time and have never taken a college program, a college course dealing anything with principles of education whatsoever. And then you've got people that are at the other end of the spectrum. So I really think that your enthusiasm needs to stay there, but the practicality for the practitioner needs to be there and stuff. And as I said, I've played with concept maps years ago and I have not gone back to them and I can't tell you why. Obviously I'm going to do a little reading after tonight's episode with the stuff in the show notes.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand what you're saying. It's a constant challenge. My research definitely focuses on my dissertation is steering me towards, it's very qualitative in nature. I'm focusing very much on the instructor's benefits, not necessarily on the student's learning gains per se. I'm not in any way, shape, or form necessarily attempting to resubstantiate or anything the literature showing that that the students have benefits from doing concept maps. And but I think it is something definitely that warrants showing that within the particular field of emergency medical services, that this particular unique group of learners, because I think within the emergency medical services community, the students are unique learners, a lot of them being adults, most of them being adults, actually. And I think, I mean, let's just admit, most of us, we're not necessarily in it because we want to be all in our books and everything. Most of us want to be out there performing the skills. So I think we're dealing with a very unique type of learner. And so I think a lot of the research could use redoing, per se. And that is something that I actually had a pretty interesting discussion about recently in a medical education research group setting, where they were talking about the use of concept maps and how they actually tailor the use of concept maps depending on the learner type. And to my knowledge, I haven't really seen any research on that.
Yep, and I can't say I've seen anything either.
You know, so as we get close to wrapping up here, it's sort of interesting to think about, you know, oftentimes when we talk about something in education, you know, there's already a lot of existing research, and then the question is asked, like, well, has this ever been looked at specifically in paramedic education? I face that frequently related to the work I do with online education, is that, you know, there's lots of K through 12 and college level or professional education online research that's going on, but very little that's taking a look at online education with EMTs and paramedics. And interesting that maybe what you found is that there's research lacking in all disciplines, and you're starting that research in EMS. And then maybe people in other vocational fields or allied health will be like, oh, what, you know, how would this impact our curriculum and student types? So it's really interesting, and definitely something I find myself like, I really want to sit down with a group of people and make a concept map. I feel like that would really come alive for me then, of making one and then sending it through the analysis process to then get feedback on, you know, how I did compared to other people making that same concept map. David, do you have a closing thought or a question for Laura?
I've thoroughly enjoyed being on here tonight, and I kind of like I do have one further question. Looking at apps to do this with, has this ever been called mind mapping, just out of curiosity?
So a mind map it's very similar to concept mapping. A mind map is it's a lot more, it's not hierarchical in nature, and in terms of the type of concept map that I've been analyzing, a mind map looks very similar to the type of concept map I've been analyzing. And so in terms of using the analysis technique that I've come up with, I truly believe that you could use my technique on a mind map. It just has to do with who coined which technique. Joseph Novak came up with concept mapping, and Buzan came up with mind mapping. And so there's different software to do each type.
Well, then I say this, and this can be my recommendation for the end of the show here, Greg, is you go to the App Store on your iPad, and there's one called Total Recall Mind Map, and that's the mind mapping version. And then they've got another one called Mental, which is a concept mapping app for the iPad. So you don't have to draw. You can let your iPad do the work for you.
Well, great. Bill, do you have a final thought or question for Laura before we move formally into recommendations?
No, but I do want to I want to thank her for the time and the conversation. I'll be interested to see your your dissertation when you actually get to that point, since I know eventually it will be out there for all of us to read. But David, you amaze me with your ability to find an app here and an app there in such a short period of time.
It's that search function, Bill. You can find a lot of stuff. Yeah, you know, Laura, like it will be interesting. You know, I'll look forward to when you send us an email with a PDF attached saying, "Here's the paper I had published." You know, that's probably a couple of years away, don't you think?
You know, I keep telling my advisor I'm going to get it done in a year, and he keeps saying, "No, Laura, it's going to take at least a year and a half."
Well, you might get everything written, but then once you start submitting to journals and it goes through the peer review process and you make revisions and it gets accepted and then it finally makes it into print, it could be years away, and then by then you'll be in some academic position somewhere, right?
Yes, hopefully.
Or maybe you'll be haunted by Bill's words at the beginning of the show and you'll be in the middle of your second year of medical school thinking, "Oh, remember when I just got to sit back and watch paramedic students struggle with concept maps?"
yeah, exactly. Or I just got to teach all the pre-meds? No.
Well, we sure appreciate you being on the show and your willingness to talk this through with us. And, you know, some topics I think probably lend themselves better to audio-only discussion, and this maybe wasn't one of those topics, just because I think we're all just like, "Oh, we need a visual here." But listeners, you can find some links in the show notes that Laura's created that can give you some visuals, and maybe David's going to make some maps with that iPad app, and he'll be throwing some links up at facebook.com/EMSEducast so we can look at what he's doing. How's that sound, David?
We can make it happen, I'm sure.
All right. So we always conclude with some recommendations. Laura, I know I didn't give you much lead time, but do you have a book or an app or an event or something that you would want to recommend to our listeners, EMS educators around the world?
So I really want everybody to give that CMAP Tools a try.
Okay. And I put a link already to that in the show notes. It says it's called IHMC CMAP Tools. Is that?
Yes.
What's that stand for, IHMC CMAP Tools? Do you know?
It's Institute for Human. I'm going to get the M wrong, and then it's cognition.
Okay. We need a concept map for that, right?
Yeah. Hold on. I can get it for you right now. Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition.
Oh, so there's that machine piece that I was getting at earlier. I would think if you have enough paramedic students generating enough of these maps that they all could end up in some online repository, and then there's some computer algorithm searching through these, looking for the things they have in common, right?
Yeah, no, the software is pretty powerful. I haven't even touched on how powerful it is in terms of the sharing and capabilities and the collaborative creation of concept maps yet.
Well, possibly fodder for a future show. Gosh, I keep getting confused about who's actually on tonight. I know it's Bill and not Rob. Bill, do you have a recommendation?
Yes, I do. I'm going to start putting the plug-in for the American Heart Association's Resuscitation Science Symposium 2013. It's going to be held November 16th and 17th at the Omni Dallas Hotel in Dallas, Texas. If you are truly interested in medical and trauma resuscitation science and you want to be around what I consider the true greats of the field, this is a this is truly the symposium to come to. It's affordable. It's a Saturday, Sunday, very full packed days, but you'll get a great deal out of it, and you'll be hearing from the people that are truly doing the cutting edge research from around the world on both cardiac as well as trauma resuscitation. And I strongly encourage people to attend it, and I figured I'd start plugging it early.
Great. And that's November 16th to 17th?
November 16th and 17th. Yes, that's the two-day program, which is just called the Resuscitation Science Symposium. It is connected with the American Heart Association Scientific Assembly, which goes on for several more days after that.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get a link to that in the show notes as well. And then my recommendation is on the NPR show Talk of the Nation a couple days ago. I guess you might be listening to this weeks from now, but in middle of May, they had a really interesting conversation about telemedicine, and they were specifically talking to a neurologist who does telemedicine for patients with Parkinson's, and how he was able to, through a five-state area, the five states where he was licensed, able to provide ongoing sort of assessment and care to this group of patients. And it was really interesting conversation because at the same time, the NEMSMA, the National EMS Management Association, also has a thread about telemedicine. And, you know, I'm sort of really struck by, you know, this is sort of another area of healthcare that's just going to happen whether EMS gets involved or not. And, you know, I, of course, would be a proponent of, you know, we should be beating on doors with other leaders in healthcare saying, how can we, EMS, get involved with this the thing called telemedicine? And some of you are probably thinking, EMS has been involved in this for decades. And, yes, that's true. But, you know, telemedicine is now potentially happening in any house with an internet connection in the world. So how do you want to engage with that? And I think those might be two good areas to start. Thank you, everyone. On behalf of Rob Terrio and Bill Toon and David Blevins and Brian Lilly and Jeff Anderson and all the other people that make the EMS Educast happen in different places, we sure appreciate your listening and support of the show.